Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. It's gratifying, but not in the least surprising, to see so many of you turning out on a beautiful Sunday afternoon to hear Ian McEwan, who's now established as one of our most interesting writers, one of the stars of Cape's ruling triumvirate, if you like, of Martin Amis and Julian Barnes and Ian McEwan. And even in that company, he was always the wild boy who came out of the MA at East Anglia in creative writing, its first alumnus, with a collection of short stories about 20 years ago called First Love, Last Rites, which shook the literary world, partly because of its quality, also because it included a story that was empathetic to a child molester, and another story about a young boy's determination to have sex with his sister, which was fulfilled. Since then, he has, in his novels, embraced the domestic, the political, the scientific, the philosophical. He has shocked us with unforgettable scenes, the scene of the disappearance of a child taken from a supermarket in The Child in Time, the dismemberment scene in The Innocent, the shocking denouement in The Comfort of Strangers, the dogs that embodied evil in Black Dogs, the ballooning accident in Enduring Love. He's written TV plays, one of which was banned, Solid Geometry, which was based on one of his short stories. He's written two screenplays, and he has since been applauded by all the major prizes. The Innocent won the Whitbread. The Booker shortlistings were a regular occurrence before Amsterdam won the Booker Prize last year. It's a great privilege for me to be here and to be allowed to hear him reading from that Booker Prize-winning book. After the reading, you will have your opportunity to ask questions. But in the meantime, I will hand over to Ian McEwan.
Thank you. Well, it is very kind of you to turn out on such a beautiful afternoon. I wouldn't be here but for the fact that I have to read to you. I'm going to say as little as possible before this reading so we can chat about anything you want afterwards. I'm going to read from Amsterdam. And since I'm reading from the beginning and then just jumping around once or twice to give you a kind of novel within a novel, I think it more or less gives you a slice of the novel's background and atmosphere. One thing to say is that Amsterdam is a historical novel. It was written in 1997. It's set in 1996. In the dying days of the major era, which now seems incredibly long ago. That's why I do think of this as a historical novel. Two former lovers of Molly Lane stood waiting outside the crematorium chapel with their backs to the February chill. It had all been said before, but they said it again. She never knew what hit her. When she did, it was too late. Rapid onset. Poor Molly. Poor Molly. It began with a tingling in her arm as she raised it outside the Dorchester grill to stop a cab, a sensation that never went away. Within weeks, she was fumbling for the names of things. Parliament, chemistry, propeller. She could forgive herself. But less so, bed, cream, mirror. It was after the temporary disappearance of acanthus and brassaula that she sought medical advice, expecting reassurance. Instead, she was sent for tests and, in a sense, never returned. How quickly feisty Molly became the sickroom prisoner of her morose, possessive husband, George. Molly, restaurant critic, gorgeous wit and photographer, the daring gardener who had been loved by the Foreign Secretary and could still turn a perfect cartwheel at the age of 46. The speed of her descent into madness and pain became a matter of common gossip. the loss of control of bodily function, and with it all sense of humour, and then the tailing off into vagueness interspersed with episodes of ineffectual violence and muffled shrieking. It was the sight now of George emerging from the chapel that caused Molly's lovers to move further up the weedy gravel path. They wandered into an arrangement of oval rose beds marked by a sign, the Garden of Remembrance. Each plant had been savagely cut back to within a few inches of the frozen ground, a practice Molly used to deplore. The patch of lawn was strewn with flattened cigarette butts, for this was a place where people came to stand about and wait for the funeral party ahead of theirs to clear the building. As they strolled up and down, the two old friends resumed the conversation they had had in various forms a half dozen times before, but which gave them rather more comfort than singing Pilgrim. Clive Linley had known Molly first, back when they were students in 68 and lived together in a chaotic, shifting household in the Vale of Health. A terrible way to go. He watched his own vaporized breath float off into the grey air. The temperature in central London was said to be minus 11 today. Minus 11. There was something seriously wrong with the world for which neither God nor his absence could be blamed. Man's first disobedience, the fall, a falling figure, an oboe, 9 notes, 10 notes. Clive had the gift of perfect pitch and he heard them descending from the G. There was no need to write them down. He continued, I mean to die that way, with no awareness, like an animal, to be reduced, humiliated before she could make arrangements or even say goodbye. It crept up on her and then he shrugged. They came to the end of the trampled lawn, turned and walked back. She would have killed herself rather than end up like that, Vernon Halliday said. He had lived with her for a year in Paris in 74 when he had his first job with Reuters and Molly did something or other for Vogue. Brain dead and in George's clutches, Clive said. George was the sad, rich publisher who doted on her and whom, to everyone's surprise, she had not left, though she always treated him badly. They looked now to where he stood outside the door, receiving commiseration from a group of mourners. Her death had raised him from general contempt. He appeared to have grown an inch or two. His back had straightened. His voice had deepened. A new dignity had narrowed his pleading, greedy eyes. Refusing to consign her to a home, he had cared for her with his own hands, and more to the point, in the early days, when people still wanted to see her, he vetted her visitors. Clive and Vernon were strictly rationed because they were considered to make her excitable and afterwards depressed about her condition. Another key male, the Foreign Secretary, was also unwelcome. People began to mutter. There were muted references in a couple of gossip columns. And then it no longer mattered because the word was she was horribly not herself. People didn't want to go and see her and were glad that George was there to prevent them. Clive and Vernon, however, continued to enjoy loathing him. As they turned about again, the phone in Vernon's pocket rang. He excused himself and stepped aside, leaving his friend to proceed alone. Clive drew his overcoat about him and slowed his pace. There must have been over 200 in the black-suited crowd outside the crematorium now. Soon it would seem rude not to go over and say something to George. He'd got her, finally, when she couldn't recognize her own face in the mirror. He could do nothing about her affairs, but in the end she was entirely his. Clive was losing the sensation in his feet, and as he stamped them, the rhythm gave him back the 10-note falling figure, ritardando, a cor anglais, and rising softly against it, contrapuntally, cellos in mirror image. Her face in it, the end. All he wanted now was the warmth, the silence of his studio, the piano, the unfinished score, and to reach the end. He heard Vernon say in parting, fine, rewrite the stand first and run it on page 4. I'll be there in a couple of hours. Then he said to Clive, bloody Israelis, we ought to wander over. I suppose so. But instead, they took another turn about the lawn, for they were there, after all, to bury Molly. With a visible effort of concentration, Vernon resisted the anxieties of his office. She was a lovely girl. Remember the snooker table? In 1978, a group of friends rented a large house in Scotland for Christmas. Molly and the man she was going about with at the time, a QC named Brady, staged an Adam and Eve tableau on a disused snooker table. He and his wife fronts, she in bra and panties, a cue rest for a snake and a red ball for an apple. The story handed down, however, the one that had appeared in an obituary and was remembered that way even by some who were present, was that Molly danced naked on Christmas Eve on a snooker table in a Scottish castle. A lovely girl, Clive repeated. She had looked right at him when she pretended to bite the apple and smiled raunchily through her chomping with one hand on a jutting hip like a music hall parody of a tart. He thought it was a signal, the way she held his gaze, and sure enough, they were back together that April. She moved into the studio in South Kensington and stayed through the summer. This was about the time her restaurant column was taking off, and when she went on television to denounce the Michelin guide as the kitsch of cuisine. And it was also the time of his own first break, the orchestral variations at the Festival Hall. Second time around. She probably hadn't changed, but he had. 10 years on, he'd learnt enough to let her teach him something. He'd always been of the hammer and tongs school. She taught him sexual stealth, the occasional necessity of stillness. Lie still, like this. Look at me, really look at me. We're a time bomb. He was almost 30. By today's standards, a late developer. And when she found a place of her own and packed her bags, he asked her to marry him. And she kissed him and quoted in his ear, "He married a woman to stop her getting away. Now she's there all day." She was right, for when she went, he was happier than ever before to be alone and wrote the 3 autumn songs in less than a month. "Did you ever learn anything from her?" Clive asked suddenly. In the mid-80s, Vernon too had had a second bite, on holiday on an estate in Umbria. Then he was Rome correspondent for the paper he now edited and a married man. "I can never remember sex," he said after a pause. "I'm sure it was brilliant, but I do remember her teaching me all about porcini, picking them, cooking them." Clive assumed this was an evasion and decided against any confidences of his own. He looked over towards the chapel entrance. They would have to go across. He surprised himself by saying rather savagely, "You know, I should have married her. When she started to go under, I would have killed her with a pillow or something and saved her from everyone's pity." Vernon was laughing as he steered his friend away from the Garden of Remembrance. "Easily said. I can just see you writing exercise yard anthems for the cons, like, what's her name, the suffragette. Ethel Smythe? I'd do a damn better job than she did." The friends of Molly, who made up the funeral gathering, would have preferred not to be at a crematorium, but George had made it clear there was to be no memorial service. He did not want to hear these 3 former lovers publicly comparing notes from the pulpits of St. Martin's or St. James, or exchanging glances while he made his own speech. As Clive and Vernon approached, they heard the familiar gabble of a cocktail party. No champagne trays, no restaurant walls to throw back the sound, but otherwise one might have been at one more gallery opening, one more media launch. So many faces Clive had never seen by daylight, and looking terrible, like cadavers jerked upright to welcome the newly dead. Invigorated by this jolt of misanthropy, he moved sleekly through the din, ignored his name when it was called, withdrew his elbow when it was plucked, and kept on going towards where George stood talking to 2 women and a shriveled old cove with a fedora and stick. "It's too cold, we have to go," Clive heard a voice cry out. But for the moment, no one could escape the centripetal power of a social event. He had already lost Vernon, who had been pulled away by the owner of a television channel. At last, Clive was gripping George's hand in a reasonable display of sincerity. "It was a wonderful service. It was very kind of you to come." Her death had ennobled him. The quiet gravity really wasn't his style at all, which had always been both needy and dour, anxious to be liked, but incapable of taking friendliness for granted, a burden of the hugely rich. "Do excuse me," he added. "These are the Finch sisters, Vera and Minnie, who knew Molly from her Boston days. Clive Linley." They shook hands. "You're the composer?" Vera or Minnie asked. "That's right. It's a great honour, Mr. Linley. My 11-year-old granddaughter studied your sonatina for her grade exam in violin and really loved it." "That's very nice to know." The thought of children playing his music made him feel faintly depressed. "And this," George said, "also from the States, is Hart Pullman." "Hart Pullman, at last. Do you remember? I set your rage poems for jazz orchestra." Pullman was the beat poet, the last survivor of the Kerouac generation. He was a withered little lizard of a man who was having trouble twisting his neck to look up at Clive. "These days I don't remember a thing, not a fucking thing," he said pleasantly in a high-pitched, chirpy voice. "But if you said you did it, you did it." You remember Molly, though, Clive said. Who? Pullman kept a straight face for 2 seconds, then cackled and clutched at Clive's forearm with slender white fingers. Oh, sure, he said in his Bugs Bunny voice. Molly and me go way back to 65 in the East Village. I remember Molly. Oh, boy. Clive concealed his disquiet as he did the sums. She would have turned 16 in the June of that year. Why had she never mentioned it? He probed neutrally. She came out for the summer, I suppose. She came to my 12th night party. What a girl! Statutory rape, then. 3 years before him. She never told him about Hart Pullman. And didn't she come to the premiere of Rage? Didn't she come to the restaurant afterwards? He couldn't remember. Not a fucking thing. George had turned his back to talk to the American sisters, deciding there was nothing to lose. Clive cupped his hand about his mouth and leaned down to speak in Pullman's ear. You never fucked her, you lying reptile. She wouldn't have stooped to it. It wasn't his intention to walk away at this point, for he wanted to hear Pullman's reply. But just then, two loud groups cut in from left and right, one to pay respects to George, the other to honor the poet, and in a swirl of repositioning, Clive found himself freed and walking away. Hart Pullman and the teenage Molly. Sickened, he pushed his way back through the crowd and arrived in a small clearing and stood there, mercifully ignored, looking around at the friends and acquaintances absorbed in conversation. He felt himself to be the only one who really missed Molly. Perhaps if he had married her, he would have been worse than George and wouldn't even have tolerated this gathering, nor her helplessness. Tipping from the little squarish brown plastic bottle 30 sleeping pills into his palm, the pestle and mortar, a tumbler of scotch, 3 tablespoons of the yellow-white sludge, she looked at him when she took it as if she knew, and with his left hand he cupped her chin to catch the spill. He held her while she slept, and then, all through the night. Nobody else was missing her. He looked around at his fellow mourners now, many of them his own age, Molly's age, to within a year or two. How prosperous, how influential, how they had flourished under a government they had despised for almost 17 years. Talking about my generation. Such energy, such luck. Nurtured in the post-war settlement with the state's own milk and juice, and then sustained by their parents' tentative, innocent prosperity, and then to come of age in full employment, new universities, bright paperback books, the Augustan age of rock and roll, affordable ideals. When the ladder crumbled behind them, when the state withdrew her tit and became a scold, they were already safe. They consolidated and settled down to forming this or that, taste, opinion, fortunes. He heard a woman call out merrily, "I can't feel my hands or feet and I'm going." And as he turned, he saw a young man behind him who had been about to touch his shoulder. He was in his mid-20s and bald or shorn and wore a grey suit with no overcoat. "Mr. Linley, I'm sorry to intrude on your thoughts," the young man said, drawing his hand away. Clive assumed he was a musician or someone come to collect his autograph and shrank his face into its mask of patience. "That's all right. I was wondering if you'd have time to come across and meet and talk to the Foreign Secretary. He's keen to meet you." Clive pursed his lips. He didn't want to be introduced to Julian Garmany, but nor did he want to go to the bother of snubbing him. No escape. "You show the way," he said, and was led past standing clumps of his friends, some of whom guessed where he was going and tried to lure him from his guide. "Hey, Linley, no talking to the enemy." The enemy, indeed. What had attracted her? He was a strange-looking fellow. Large head, with wavy black hair that was all his own, a terrible pallor, thin, unsensual lips. He had made a life in the political marketplace with an unexceptional stall of xenophobic and punitive opinions. Vernon's explanation had always been simple. High-ranking bastard, hot in the sack. Bet she could have found that anywhere. There must have been also been the hidden talent that had got him to where he was, and even now was driving him to challenge the Prime Minister for his job. The aide delivered Clive into a horseshoe grouped around Garmany, who appeared to be making a speech or telling a story. He broke off to slip his hand into Clive's and murmur intensely as though they were alone, "I've been wanting to meet you for years." "How do you do?" Garmany spoke up for the benefit of the company, two of whom were young men with the pleasant, openly dishonest look of diary page people. The minister was performing and Clive was a kind of prop. "My wife knows a few of your piano pieces by heart." Again, Clive wondered. Was he as domesticated and tame a talent as some of his younger critics claimed? The thinking man's Goreski. She must be good, he said. It had been a while since he had met a politician close up. And what he had forgotten was the eye movements, the restless patrol for new listeners or defectors, or the proximity of some figure of higher status or some other main chance that might slip by. Garmany was looking round now, securing his audience. She was brilliant. Goldsmiths, then the Guildhall, a fabulous career ahead of her. He paused for comic effect. Then she met me, chose medicine. Only the aide and another staffer, a woman, tittered. The journalists were unmoved. Perhaps they'd heard it all before. The Foreign Secretary's eyes had settled back on Clive. There was another thing. I wanted to congratulate you on your commission, the Millennial Symphony. Do you know that decision went right up to cabinet level? So I heard, and you voted for me. Clive had allowed himself a note of weariness, but Garmany reacted as though he had been effusively thanked. Well, it was the least I could do. Some of my colleagues wanted this pop star chap, the ex-Beatle. Anyway, how's it coming along? Almost done? Almost. His extremities had been numb for half an hour, but it was only now that the chill finally enveloped his core. In the warmth of his studio, he would be in shirt sleeves working on the final pages of this symphony, whose premiere was only weeks away. He'd already missed two deadlines, and he longed to be home. He put out his hand to Garmany. It was very nice to meet you. I have to be getting along. But the minister did not take his hand and was speaking over him, for there was still a little more to be wrung from the famous composer's presence. Do you know, I've often thought that it's the freedom of artists like yourself to pursue your work that makes my own job worthwhile. More followed in similar style. As Clive gazed on, no sign of his growing distaste showing in his expression. Garmany, too, was his generation. High office had eroded his ability to talk levelly with a stranger. Perhaps that was what he had offered her in bed, the thrill of the impersonal, a man twitching in front of mirrors. But surely she preferred emotional warmth. Lie still, look at me, really look at me. Perhaps it was nothing more than a mistake, Molly and Garmany. Either way, Clive now found it unbearable. The Foreign Secretary reached his conclusion. These are the traditions that make us what we are. I was wondering, Clive said to Molly's ex-lover, whether you're still in favour of hanging. Garmany was well able to deal with this sudden shift, but his eyes had hardened. I think most people are aware of my position on that. Meanwhile, I'm happy to accept the view of Parliament and the collective responsibility of the Cabinet. He had squared up, and he was also turning on the charm. The two journalists edged a little closer with their notebooks. I see you once said in a speech that Nelson Mandela deserved to be hanged. Garmany, who was due to visit South Africa the following month, smiled calmly. The speech had recently been dug up rather scurrilously by Vernon's paper. I don't think you can reasonably nail people to things they said as hothead undergraduates. He paused to chuckle. Almost 30 years ago. I bet you said or thought some pretty shocking things yourself. I certainly did, Clive said, which is my point. If you'd had your way then, there wouldn't be much chance for second thoughts now. Garmany inclined his head briefly in acknowledgement. Fair enough, point. But in the real world, Mr. Linley, no justice system can ever be free of human error. And then the Foreign Secretary did an extraordinary thing, which quite destroyed Clive's theory about the effects of public office, and which, in retrospect, he was forced to admire. Garmany reached out, and with his forefinger and thumb, caught hold of the lapel of Clive's overcoat, and drawing him closer, spoke in a voice that no one else could hear. The last time I saw Molly, she told me you were impotent and always had been. Complete nonsense. She never said that. Of course, you're bound to deny it. Thing is, we could discuss it out loud in front of the gentleman over there, or you could get off my case and make a pleasant farewell. That is to say, fuck off. The delivery was rapid and urgent, and as soon as it was over, Garmany leaned back, beaming as he pumped the composer's hand and called out to the aide, Mr. Linley has kindly accepted an invitation to dinner. This last may have been an agreed code, for the young man stepped across promptly to usher Clive away, while Garmany turned his back on him to say to the journalists, a great man, Clive Linley, and to air differences and remain friends, the essence of civilized existence, don't you think? That's Clive, and now I'm going to give you a little of his friend Vernon. Amsterdam is in part the story. I'm just going to get some water. Is in part the story of Clive and Vernon falling out and really not fulfilling the conditions of a civilized existence. Both men fall to fears of death in the wake of Molly's funeral. Clive, convinced that he's got just the tingling in the arm that Molly had. And Vernon becomes afflicted by something that I think those of you who work in very busy offices in positions of responsibility may have some sense of. A sense of not existing when you're alone. I think it's a peculiarly modern complaint. And with Vernon, this sense is so pervasive that even in the night he has to touch his own face to reassure himself that he's a physical entity. The newspaper that Vernon works for, various critics kindly pointed out it was the Times, and others said it was the Observer. Still more said it was the Guardian. It actually is a conflation of all of these. Many broadsheets have had to, or perhaps all broadsheets have had to, take some part of their paper down market to compete for circulation from what they call the upper range of the tabloids. That's the Mail and the Express. Anyway, had Vernon taken a few of his senior staff aside in the canteen and confided about his condition, he might have been alarmed by their lack of surprise. He was widely known as a man without edges, without faults or virtues, as a man who did not fully exist. Within his profession, Vernon was revered as a non-entity. It was one of the marvels of newspaper lore, difficult to exaggerate and often recounted in city wine bars, the manner in which he had become the editor of the Judge. Years back, he had been the bland and hard-working lieutenant for two gifted editors in succession and had shown an instinctive talent for making neither friends nor allies. When the Washington correspondent fell ill, Vernon was ordered to stand in for him. In his third month at a dinner for the German ambassador, a congressman mistook Vernon for a writer on the Washington Post and tipped him off about a presidential indiscretion, a radical hair implant procured at taxpayers' expense. It was generally accepted that Pategate, a story that dominated American domestic politics for almost a week, had been broken by Vernon Halliday of the Judge. Meanwhile, back in London, one gifted editor was falling to another in bloody battles with a meddlesome board of directors. Vernon's return home coincided with a sudden realignment of proprietorial interest. The stage was littered with the severed limbs and torsos of titans cut down to size. Jack Moby, the board's own placeman, had failed to take the venerable broadsheet far enough down market. There was no one left but Vernon. Now he sat at his desk and tentatively massaged his scalp. Lately, he had realized he was learning to live with this non-existence. He could not mourn for long the passing of something, himself, that he could no longer quite recall. All this was a worry, but it was a worry that was several days old. There was now a physical symptom. It involved the whole of the right side of his head, both skull and brain somehow, a sensation for which there was simply no word. Or it might have been the sudden interruption of a sensation so constant and familiar that he had not been conscious of it, like a sound one becomes aware of the moment it stops. He knew exactly when it had begun, the night before as he stood up from dinner, and it was there when he woke in the morning, continuous and indefinable, not cold or tight or airy, though somewhere in between. Perhaps the word was dead. His right hemisphere had died. He knew so many people who had died that in his present state of dissociation, he could begin to contemplate his own end as commonplace. A flurry of burying or cremating, a welt of grief raised then subsiding as life swept on. Perhaps he had already died. Or again, and he thought this strongly, perhaps all that was needed was a couple of sharp taps to the side of the head with a medium-sized hammer. He opened his desk drawer. There was a metal ruler left by Moby, fourth editor in succession to fail to reverse the Judge's declining circulation. Vernon Halliday was trying not to be the fifth. He had raised the ruler several inches above his right ear when there was a knock on his open door, and Jean, his secretary, entered, and he was obliged to convert the blow into a pensive scratching. The schedule, 20 minutes. She peeled off a sheet and gave it to him and left the rest on the conference table as she went out. He scanned the lists. Under foreign, Dibben was writing on Garmany's Washington Triumph. That would need to be a sceptical piece or a hostile one, and if it really was a triumph, it could stay off the front page. Under the home list was, at long last, the piece by the science editor on an anti-gravity machine from a university in Wales. It was an attention grabber, and Vernon had pushed for it, half dreaming of a gizmo you strapped to the bottom of your shoes. In fact, the thing turned out to weigh 4 tons, required 9 million volts, and didn't work. They were running it anyway at the bottom of the front page. Also under home was Piano Quartet, quadruplets born to a concert pianist. His deputy, along with features, and the whole home desk were fighting him over this, hiding their fastidiousness behind a pretense of realism. 4 wasn't enough these days, they were saying, and no one had ever heard of the mother, who wasn't pretty anyway and didn't want to talk to the press. Vernon had overruled them. Last month's ABC average was 7,000 lower than the month before. Time was running out for the judge. He was still considering whether to run a story about Siamese twins joined at the hip. One had a weak heart, so they couldn't be separated, who had secured a job in local government. If we're going to save this paper, Vernon liked to say at the morning editorial conference, you're all going to have to get your hands dirty. Everyone nodded. Nobody agreed. As far as the old hands, the grammarians, were concerned, the judge would stand or fall by its intellectual probity. They felt safe in this view because no one on the paper, say, apart from Vernon's predecessors, had ever been sacked. The first of the section editors and deputies were filing in when Jean waved to him from the door to pick up the phone. It had to be important because she was mouthing a name. George Lane, her lips said. Vernon turned his back on the room and remembered how he had avoided George at the funeral. George, a deeply moving occasion. I was going to drop you a... Yes, yes. Something's come up. I think you should see it. What sort of thing? Photographs. Can you bike them round? Absolutely not, Vernon. This is very, very hot. Can't you come now? Not all Vernon's contempt for George Lane had to do with Molly. Lane owned 1.5% of the judge and had put money into the relaunch that marked the fall of Jack Moby and Vernon's elevation. George thought that Vernon was in his debt. Also, George knew nothing about newspapers, which was why he thought that the editor of a national daily could saunter out of his office to cross the entire width of London to Holland Park at 11:30 in the morning. I'm rather busy at present, Vernon said. I'm doing you a big favour here, sort of thing the News of the World would kill for. I could be there sometime after 9 this evening. Very well, I'll see you then, George said huffily and rang off. By now, every chair but one at the conference table had been taken, and as George lowered himself into it, the conversation subsided. He touched the side of his head. Now that he was in company again, back on the job, his interior absence was no longer an affliction. Yesterday's paper was spread before him. He said into the near silence, "Who subbed the environment leader?" "Pat Redpath." "On this paper, hopefully, is not a sentence adverb, nor will it ever be, especially in a leader, for God's sakes. And none..." He trailed away for dramatic effect while pretending to scan the piece. "None usually takes a singular verb. Can we get these two things generally understood?" Vernon was aware of the approval round the table. This was the kind of thing the grammarians liked to hear. Together, they would see the paper into the grave with its syntax pure. Crowd pleasers dispensed, he pressed on at speed. One of his few successful innovations, perhaps his only one so far, was to have reduced the daily conference from 40 to 15 minutes by means of a few modestly imposed rules. No more than 5 minutes on the post-mortem, what's done is done, no joke-telling, and above all, no anecdotes. He didn't tell them, so no one else could. He turned to the international pages and frowned. An exhibition of pottery shards in Ankara, a news item, 800 words. I simply don't get it, Frank. Frank Dibben, the deputy foreign editor, explained with perhaps a trace of mockery. Well, you see, Vernon, it represents a fundamental paradigm shift in our understanding of the influence of the early Persian Empire. And paradigm shifts in broken pots aren't news, Frank. Grant MacDonald, the deputy editor, who was sitting at Vernon's elbow, cut in gently. Thing is, Julie failed to file from Rome. They had to fill the... Not again. What is it now? Hepatitis C. Well, what about AP? Dibben spoke up. This was more interesting. You're wrong. It's a complete turn-off. Even the TLS wouldn't run it. They moved on to the day's schedule. In turn, the editors summarised the stories on their lists. When it came to Frank's turn, he pushed for his Garmany story to lead the front page. Vernon heard him out and said, "He's in Washington when he should be in Brussels. He's cutting a deal with the Americans behind the Germans' backs. Short-term gain, long-term disaster. He was a terrible Home Secretary. He's even worse at the Foreign Office, and he'll be the ruin of us if he's ever Prime Minister, which is looking more and more likely." "Well, yes," Frank agreed, his softness of tone concealing his fury about the anchor put down. "You said all that in your leader, Vernon. Surely the point is not whether we agree with the deal, but whether it's significant." Vernon was wondering whether he might just bring himself to let Frank go. What was he doing wearing an earring? "Quite right, Frank," Vernon said cordially. "We're in Europe. The Americans want us in Europe. The special relationship is history. The deal is no significance. The coverage stays on the inside pages. Meanwhile, we'll continue to give Garmany a hard time." They listened to the sports editor, whose pages Vernon had recently doubled at the expense of arts and books. And then it was the turn of Letice O'Hara, the features editor. "I need to know if we can go ahead with the Welsh Children's Home." Vernon said, "I've seen the guest list. A lot of big cheeses. We can't really afford the legal costs if it goes wrong." Letice looked relieved and began to describe an investigative piece she had commissioned on a medical scandal in Holland. "Apparently, there are doctors exploiting the euthanasia laws to..." Vernon interrupted her. "I want to run the Siamese twin story in Friday's paper." There were groans. But who was going to object first? It was Letice. "We don't even have a picture. So send someone to Middlesbrough this afternoon." There was a sullen silence. So Vernon continued, "Look, they work in a section of the local hygiene department called forward planning. It's a sub-stream." The home editor, Jeremy Ball, said, "We spoke last week and it was okay. Then he phoned yesterday. I mean, it was the other half, the other head. Doesn't want to talk, doesn't want a picture." "Oh, God," Vernon cried. "Don't you see? That's all part of the story. They've fallen out. First thing anyone would want to know, how do they settle disputes?" Letice was looking gloomy. She said, "Apparently there are bite marks on both faces." "Brilliant," Vernon exclaimed. "No one else is onto this. Friday, please. Page 3. Now moving on. Letice. This 8-page chess supplement. Frankly, I'm not convinced." Finally, and briefly, I'd like to read to you the beginning of Clive and Vernon's falling out. Vernon has been to collect the photographs that George was so anxious for him to see, and he's brought these photographs round to Clive's house. Clive was just on his way up to the Lake District. He's got stuck with his symphony and wanted to take a long walk to sort out his ideas, but Vernon's an old friend, so he rearranged his travel plans, brought up two good burgundies from the cellar and cooked. Vernon arrived an hour late, and Clive's first impression was that his friend had lost weight. His face was long and thin and unshaved, his overcoat looked many sizes too large, and when he set down his briefcase to accept a glass of wine, his hand was trembling. He downed the Chambertin Clos de Bez like a lager and said, "What a week, what a terrible week." He held out his glass for a refill, and Clive, relieved that he had not started with the Richebourg, obliged. "We were in court 3 hours this morning and we won. You'd think that would be the end of it, but the whole staff's against me." "Almost all of them, anyway. The building's in uproar. It's a marvel we got a paper out tonight. There's a chapel meeting going on now, and they're certain to pass a motion of no confidence in me. Management and the board are standing firm, so that's fine. It's a fight to the death." Clive gestured towards a chair, and Vernon flopped into it, put his elbows on the kitchen table, covered his face with his hands, and wailed, "These prissy bastards, I'm trying to save their arse-wiped newspaper and their piss-pot jobs. They'd rather lose everything than dangle a single fucking modifier. They don't live in the real world. They deserve to starve." Clive had no idea what Vernon was talking about, but he said nothing. Vernon's glass was empty again, so Clive filled it and turned away to lift two poussins from the oven. Vernon heaved the briefcase onto his lap. Before opening it, he took a deep calming breath and another slug of the Chambertin. He sprung the catches, hesitated, and then spoke in a lower voice. "Look, I'd like your view on this, not just because you've got a personal connection and you already know a little about it. It's because you're not in the business and I need an outsider's view. I think I'm going mad. This last he was murmuring to himself as he delved into the case and produced a large cardboard-backed envelope from which he pulled three black and white photographs. Clive turned off the heat under the saucepans and sat down. The first photograph Vernon put in his hands showed Julian Garmany in a plain three-quarter-length dress, posing catwalk style, with arms pushing away a little from his body and one foot set in front of the other, knees slightly crooked. The false breasts under the dress were small, and the edge of one bra strap was visible. The face was made up, but not overly so, for his natural pallor served him well, and lipstick had bestowed a bow of sensuality on the unkind, narrow lips. The hair was distinctively Garmany's, short, wavy, and side-parted, so that his appearance was both manicured and dissolute, and faintly bovine. This was not something that could ever be passed off as fancy dress or a lark in front of the camera. The strained, self-absorbed expression was that of a man revealed in a sexual state. The strong gaze into the lens was consciously seductive. The lighting was soft and cleverly done. "Molly," Clive said, more to himself. "You've got it in one," Vernon said. He was watching hungrily, waiting for a reaction, and it was partly to conceal his thoughts that Clive continued to gaze into the picture. What he felt first was simple relief for Molly. A puzzle had been solved. This was what had drawn her to Garmany. The secret life, his vulnerability, the trust that must have bound them closer. Good old Molly. She would have been creative and playful, urging him on, taking him further into the dreams that the House of Commons could not fulfill. And he would have known that he could rely on her. If she had been ill in some other kind of way, she would have taken care to destroy these pictures. Had it ever moved beyond the bedroom? To restaurants in foreign cities? Two girls on the town? Molly would have known how. She knew the clothes and the places, and she would have adored the conspiracy and fun, the silliness and sexiness of it. Clive thought again how he loved her. "Well," Vernon said. To forestall him, Clive put out a hand for another picture. In this, a head and shoulders shot, Garmany's dress was more silkily feminine. There was a simple line of lace around the high sleeves and neckline. Perhaps it was lingerie he was wearing. The effect was less successful, unmasking completely the lurking masculinity and revealing the pathos, the impossible hopes of his confounded identity. Molly's artful lighting could not dissolve the jawbones of a huge head or disguise the swell of an Adam's apple. How he looked and how he felt he looked were probably very far apart. They should have been ridiculous, these photographs. They were ridiculous, but Clive was somewhat awed. We know so little about each other. We lie mostly submerged like ice floes, with our visible social selves projecting only cool and white. And here was a rare sight below the waves of a man's privacy and turmoil, of his dignity upended by the overpowering necessity of pure fantasy, pure thought, by the irreducible human element, mind. For the first time, Clive considered what it might be like to feel kindly towards Garmany. It was Molly who had made it possible. In the third of the pictures, he wore a boxy Chanel jacket and his gaze was turned downwards. On some mental screen of selfhood, he was a demure and feasible woman, but to an outsider what showed was evasion. "Face it, you're a man." He was better off looking to the camera, confronting us with his pretense. "So?" Vernon was becoming impatient. "Extraordinary." Clive handed the photographs back. He could not think clearly with the images still in his view. He said, "And so you're fighting to keep them out of the paper?" It was part tease, part mischief, as well as a wish to delay voicing his thoughts. Vernon was staring at him, amazed. "Are you mad? This is the enemy. I just told you we've got the injunction lifted." "Of course, sorry. Wasn't quite with it." "My idea is to publish next week. What do you think?" Clive tilted back on his chair and clasped his hands behind his head. "I think," he said carefully, "I think your staff is right. I think it's a really terrible idea." "Meaning?" "It'll ruin him." "Dead right it will. I mean, personally." "Yep." There was a stalled silence. So many objections came crowding in on Clive that they seemed to cancel each other out. Vernon pushed his empty glass across the table, and as it was filled, he said, "I don't get it. He's pure poison. You've said so yourself many times." "He's vile," Clive agreed. "The word is, he was mounting a leadership challenge in November. It would be terrible for the country if he was prime minister. I think so too, Clive said. Vernon spread his hands. So? There was another pause while Clive stared up at the cracks in the ceiling, shaping his thoughts. At last he said, tell me this. Do you think it's wrong in principle for men to dress up in women's clothes? Vernon groaned. He was beginning to behave like a drunk. He must have had a few before arriving. Oh, Clive. Clive kept on. You were once an apologist for the sexual revolution. You stood up for gays. I don't believe I'm hearing this. You stood up for plays and films that people wanted to ban. Only last year you spoke up for those cretins who were in court for hammering nails through their balls. Vernon winced. Penis, actually. Isn't this the kind of sexual expression you're so keen to defend? What exactly is Garmany's crime that needs to be exposed? It's hypocrisy, Clive. This is the hanger and flogger, the family values man, scourge of immigrants, asylum seekers, travellers, marginal people. Irrelevant, Clive said. Of course it's relevant. Don't talk crap. If it's okay to be a transvestite, then it's okay for a racist to be one. What's not okay is to be a racist. Vernon sighed in fake pity. Listen to me. But Clive had found his trope. If it's okay to be a transvestite, then it's okay for a family man to be one too, and in private, of course. If it's okay to... Clive, listen to me. You're in your studio all day dreaming up symphonies. You've no idea what's at stake. If Garmany's not stopped now, if he gets to be Prime Minister in November, they've got a good chance of winning the election next year. Another 5 years. There'll be even more people living below the poverty line, more people in prison, more homeless, more crime, more riots like last year. He's been speaking in favour of national service. The environment will suffer because he'd rather please his business friends than sign the accords on global warming. He wants to take us out of Europe. Economic catastrophe. It's all very fine for you. And here, Vernon gestured round at the enormous kitchen. But for most people... Careful, Clive growled. When you're drinking my wine... He reached for the Richebourg and filled Vernon's glass. £105 a bottle. Vernon downed half the glass. My point, precisely. You're not becoming comfortable and right-wing in your middle age, are you? Clive answered the taunt with one of his own. You know what this is really about. You're doing George's work. He's setting you on. You're being used, Vernon. And I'm surprised you can't see through it. He hates Garmany for his affair with Molly. If he had something on me or you, he'd use that too. And then Clive added, perhaps he has. Did she take any of you in the frogman's suit? Or was it the tutu? The people must be told. Vernon stood up and put the envelope back in his case. I came around hoping for your support, or at least a sympathetic hearing. I didn't expect your fucking abuse. He went out into the hall. Clive followed him, but he did not feel apologetic. Vernon opened the door and turned. He looked unwashed, wrecked. I don't get it, he said quietly. I don't think you're being straight with me. What is it you really object to about this? Possibly the question was rhetorical. Clive took a couple of steps towards his friend and answered it. Because of Molly. We don't like Garmany, but she did. He trusted her, and she respected his trust. It was something private between them. These are her pictures, nothing to do with me or you or your readers. She would have hated what you're doing. Frankly, you're betraying her. And then, rather than let Vernon have the satisfaction of closing the door on him, Clive turned and walked away towards the kitchen to eat his supper alone. Thank you.
Thank you for that splendid reading of a very entertaining piece of work. Before I'm going to let all of you ask a question, I'm going to ask one of Ian myself. One of the interesting things about Amsterdam winning the Booker is that those who were surprised by the win were surprised not because of the quality of the writing, but simply because it seemed a lighter book to them, and a shorter book, a sort of jeu d'esprit, after the four substantial tones, the quartet, as you've described it, that preceded this one. Were you surprised?
I don't know how surprised you can be at winning the Booker if you're on the shortlist, quite honestly. You have a 1 in 6 chance. I don't know. I think Booker narratives are interesting. Last year, when Enduring Love was not on a shortlist, I was the good guy. And it was rather nice. I had lots of sort of press saying outraged comment.
Exactly.
So I enjoyed all that. And then when Amsterdam was on the
actually won it. I was sort of accused of if I'd mugged a pensioner or something. It's not my fault that the innocent, the child in time, or whatever else, didn't win it. And I think the problem with the Booker, but I don't think there's any way around this problem, is it is a spinning bottle. It's a lottery. Because you know that a different panel would choose a different book each year. I don't think there's any way around this because I have some experience of the French method of awarding prizes, where the panel is made up entirely of publishers and they don't change from year to year. And the accepted convention in France is if you want to win, I won't name any prizes, I don't want to be accused of too much. There's an awful lot of networking and lunching going on around a French prize that I think would be unthinkable given that we turn over our panel each year.
Well, Enduring Love is also at the moment on the shortlist for the most lucrative prize going, which is the £85,000 Impact Award.
Yeah, that seems to me like the dream prize because it's an awful lot of money and nobody sort of pays it much attention. So you could just sort of take the money and go home and be left in peace.
Well, we'll notice.
Yeah. I realise I've scotched my chances with that saying it.
Perhaps there are some questions out there. There should be a roving mic, if the roving mic could make itself visible to me. No.
Don't have a roving mic.
No. Okay. If we can't hear you, I can repeat the question to anyone else. Does anyone have questions for Ian? Be brave. Speak up. Thank you. Gentleman in the front.
How much of your work, particularly the short stories, comes from personal experience? And how important do you think personal experience is to your writing?
Yes, how important is personal experience to your writing? How much of the work, particularly the short stories, come from your experience?
Well, I hope you'd be relieved to hear that my early short stories are not precisely autobiographical. They're more a product of a rather reckless youthful imagination, somewhat impatient at the time with the nature of the mainstream of English fiction as it was in that stretch, I guess, post-war stretch, 25 years from 1950 on. It always seemed to me rather too much of a social documentary, too much interested in describing the furniture and people's accents and the ins and outs of social mobility. So the early stories... I was often accused of writing to shock in those stories, and I used to deny it. For at least 20 years, I denied it. But I begin to think that perhaps I was writing to shock, but not in a sort of calculating way. I was writing out of a kind of impatience. The stories had about as much relation to my life as maybe a dream might, in the sort of Freudian structure of a dream. That is, if you pick it apart, you could see all the elements of your life traduced or translated to make up what people used to call the manifest content of the dream. Whatever happened to Freud? No one believes in him anymore. Personal experience, well, I mean, of course it's essential, but I've never been much interested in writing directly out of my life, and I can probably name the half dozen instances in my novels which have drawn directly from a particular experience.
One of your strengths, though, is to draw, if you like, the dark side of our own psyche. And in fact, in this extract that you've just read to us, you make reference to the part that is underneath the social surface. And you're sympathetic to the otherwise unsympathetic politician for having this dark secret life. And I wonder what attracts you to writing about that.
Well, I just find it more interesting, really. And I don't want to hide behind the rest of all literature, but I think literature generally has always been fascinated by and drawn to, addictively, compulsively, to everything that's difficult, either within people or between them. I mean, conflict makes up, covers many pages, not only of the Bible, but of Homer's writing too. And I suppose the general impulse of literature is to describe conflict and then tentatively suggest a way out. I guess one of the features of literature this century is that it doesn't always pose the way out, it simply prefers to pose the conflict. And in that, I don't think I'm particularly exceptional. I think there's maybe something common to many writers in the way we grow older. I think when I was writing my first short stories, when I was 21 or 22, I felt much more abandoned to embrace a kind of nihilism that I would find harder now, oddly enough, even though I think I've seen far worse things than I'd ever seen then. I think pessimism is almost a kind of luxury of youth, and that as you get older, especially as you have children, it becomes somewhat more incumbent upon you to find that which makes us want to go on in the face of all difficulty.
Yes, in fact, some of the novels, although you have a reputation for this dark side, do have a rather optimistic resolution. I mean, even a novel like The Child in Time has some kind of hope about the continuation of a family at the end of it.
Yeah.
Perhaps you're getting more optimistic as you get older.
Well, I don't know. It's maybe it's simply a matter of wanting to have the full range of things. I wouldn't want to get sentimental about life either, and I distrust novels that don't live out the full conclusions of their preceding 9/10 and then simply have someone at the graveside pick a flower and the sun come out, as it often does in those final paragraphs. I think optimism has to be earned, but sometimes also I think we have to have the courage of our pessimism. So it's not a simple matter, but I do think that you can permit yourself a kind of reckless abandon at the age of 22, which gets harder at the age of 50.
Yes. Other questions? Oh, loads. Let's see. Let's start with the lady over there at the back. The question was, did you used to be a road sweeper?
No, I was a dustman.
Dustman, I believe, yes.
I was never a road sweeper. Although I did have ambitions that way. but I didn't make the grade. There's in one of the my children showed me on the computer, there's an encyclopedia called Encarta, and in it says Ian McEwan, dustman turned novelist. Well, it's a bit unfair. I was a dustman in a holiday job between school and university, that was all. So I can't quite claim to have, you know, been writing between shifts. And I know that, I mean, American writers do this a lot. They say he's been a bronco buster and a, you know, supermarket packer. And you think, yeah, we've all done those holiday jobs. What's it doing on your dust jacket, pal? I did think for a while I could work on that image of having fought up from the gutter. But I never got my chance to sweep the gutter. What I did was work in Camden Town for 3 months, earning enough money to go hitchhiking off to Greece, with the full knowledge that I had a place at university. So I can't really pretend for anything else. It's just the reason I became a dustman is that after I left school, I thought what I'd do is work for the BBC because it sounded so exciting. And I signed up in a department called News Information, press cutting department. And I was also impressed that I had to sign a contract to work there. And within 4 days, I found it was so boring that I thought I'd rather be a dustman. And I broke my contract, lost my week's wages, and worked. All I can say, actually, I've never spoken in public about this side of my life. But this was before the days of the plastic bag in which the rubbish was kept. And all rubbish went straight into galvanized steel dustbins. And many of the houses of Camden Town then, and I don't know how it is now, you actually had to walk through people's sitting room and into their backyard because there was no access from the other side. and carry these incredibly heavy dustbins. Not heavy because of the contents, but heavy because of the encrusted slime that over decades had successfully diminished the volume of the dustbin. And in the first days, I lived in terror of dropping one of these dustbins in someone's sitting room. I did drop one in the street on my first day. And a very friendly road sweeper came and swept it all up. And he said, I can see it's your first day. And that's when I formed the ambition to be a road sweeper, a kindly one.
It's quite a long question.
Uh-oh.
I'll repeat this in a moment, just for people at the back, but go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, they can't hear you.
So. Yeah. I feel that they're a lot more negative, and that this is a greater, kind of almost like an insanity in some of the rhythms and the writing, which is really kind of jump off.
In the short story.
In the recent work.
Short stories.
It would be very difficult. Yes. I'm asked the difference between...
Can I just repeat a bit of that? It's a comment on the negativity of the early work and the insanity of the rhythms, which the lady is saying seems rather diminished in the later work. There doesn't seem such a quality of this sort of intense insanity, which you like, I gather. Yes. Saved her childhood.
I had this infatuation in my early 20s with replacing all the full stops in my writing with commas. And I think I must have got the idea from reading Beckett's trilogy. And it was a terrible thing to have done. And what you see as insane rhythms, I just see as bad punctuation. And my fingers itch for a blue pencil, and yet I think one has to stick with what you did. But I do find some of the what you call rhythms are. But I don't actually the rhythms themselves. I don't think are changed. I think if you look and put a full stop where or semicolons where they should be, you'll find more or less the same prose rhythms that I write with now. But then we're down to a kind of taste. As I say, I did wonder at one point whether I should repunctuate and reparagraph my first two books, and then thought, no, you mustn't do an ordin on your work. You have to let it stand as it came.
Lots of questions that you give. There's a lady over there, yes, in the white top or light colored top. How valuable was the creative writing course at East Anglia?
For me, it was an incredible stroke of luck. I was at a loose end as having just done a first degree with a grant to go and do an MA. I thought for a long time that what I wanted to do was teach at university, but that ambition was fading in my final year. And I found this course that being offered at the UEA, which is mostly an academic course. I think 11/12 of it, in fact, was comparative literature and literary theory and contemporary American novels. But one element allowed you to submit some fiction in place of an extended essay. And when I phoned, and this was the first year they'd offered this course, they told me the course had closed down because no one had applied. So I offered myself and I got taken on. But because I was the only one doing this bit of the course, it meant that really I just spent the year, when I wasn't doing the academic stuff, writing the stories that made up most of the volume of First Love, Last Rites. When I finish a story, I would take it off to show it to Malcolm Bradbury. We'd meet in a pub for half an hour. He would say some encouraging things, sometimes some disparaging things, and then say, when can I have the next one? It was really like sort of, it was as simple as that.
Do you think these courses are on the whole?
It really was a most extraordinary break for me, because when later on that year I had Angus Wilson doing the same thing for me. And I had time, sort of structured time set apart, and an expectation of that I had to deliver work. And I'm not sure that I believe that writing can be taught. I mean, I have done it myself. I taught at Iowa for a semester years ago, 1977. All the people who were good arrived good, and they left good.
So it doesn't change the way you write?
I don't think it does, but what it does do is give you set aside time and an impulse, encouragement to take yourself seriously, which you might not otherwise have. I was mostly left alone to just get on with it. Neither Malcolm Bradbury nor Angus Wilson ever said, what extraordinary, revolting short stories, so macabre, where on earth did you... I mean, so I was innocently surprised when they were published. I realized how privileged I'd been by this laissez-faire attitude. So I think they do have... They certainly can give someone a really good start in providing that structured attention.
Another question. How much had he written before he went to East Anglia?
I'd written a handful of very, very bad short stories. And a couple of radio plays that I never sent to any radio station. And a film script, which I never sent to any studio. I mean, I wrote a play and submitted it to the university theatre group. And I think my play was so bad, and I went along to the meeting with thudding heart to listen to everyone discuss what they should do for that year. And they didn't even discuss it, because I think it was one of those plays that I think everyone writes. It's the sort of play you have to get out of your system. It's a play in which everybody on the stage knows they're in a play, and at the end of the play is their death. I mean, and actually there was nothing else but that. I did all the kind of writing I think that you have to get through all my writing was entirely like someone else's. But I think that's necessary. Pastiche and parody, I think, are very much important first steps for a writer. You have to write your way through other writers.
Gentleman in the red sweater over there.
Where did you get the idea for the ballooning accident in Enduring Love?
Where did the idea for the ballooning accident in Enduring Love come from?
An old friend of mine told me he'd seen a story in a newspaper about a ballooning accident. I was never able to locate this story. It occurred in Germany, and at the time my wife was working for a newspaper which had a wonderful computer database, and she was always trying to track it down, and she used to type in balloon death Germany every now and then to see if it would give back the story. But what we did get was balloon death, and I realized that all these stories about ballooning being a very safe and sedate way of getting about are much exaggerated. She faxed me 50 closely typed pages of balloon deaths around the world for 1996. The actual story I did find long after I'd finished the book. Someone came up to me, I was reading at the National Theatre, and a young German woman said that she would send me the press cutting. And in fact, it was a man and his father trying to tether a balloon in a strong wind, and both got carried away, fell off the rope to their deaths. It was all filmed on an amateur video, which was shown on a local the TV station that night, prompting a furious debate in the German media about privacy and respect and so on, which is why it lodged in her memory. So there was a story, but I just heard the rumor of it and then really got drawn into that, the aspect of cooperation and selfishness that underpin the tensions of it.
There's a lady here. Yes. The concrete future of the child in time shocked the lady. Does he write in order to make people change the future?
Well, I'm a very keen hiker. I walk a lot, and one of the great disappointments for me of the last 30 years is the gathering discovery that you can no longer have great walks in lowland agricultural England. I mean, you used to be able to walk lanes and along hedgerows. You can do it in patches, 2 miles here and a mile there, but you can't just abandon yourself to a long walk across the Weald for a day. And what was in the Child in Time is actually based on an observation and many, many days and weekends of disappointment. 200-acre fields and no hedgerows and that general kind of disaster that's occurred in English agriculture, largely through massive government and EU subsidies, which have tended to favour a certain kind of intensive farming.
And do you hope to forestall it by the writing about it?
You reflect it, but I mean, if that was my hope, it's been rather unrealized because it's got worse. I mean, maybe we're about to change. I mean, there have been some very good things written about this in recent years. And there is an awareness that there have to be limits on intensive farming. But so far, I haven't noticed. I'm not sure you can really write. I mean, I know there are novels like Silent Spring, really written books that write like Silent Spring, which really do attempt to change things. But even that made little difference to the monoculture of American farming practice. I think you have to reflect it because of some other urgency that it has for you, and hope, it just feeds into a culture of change. But I don't think that literature really changes the world in quite such a one-on-one practice. And I think that if I really wanted to set about doing something about agricultural disasters that we've seen in our lifetime, writing novels would be a pretty inefficient way of doing it. It's better to join Friends of the Earth or the Countryside Commission.
A question from the gentleman over at the side. Try and fit in a few more questions. Yes.
When you were introduced to it, I think it was said that you shocked the literary establishment. Do you think there is such a thing as the literary establishment? And if you do, do you think it's a good thing if it's a free one? And whatever is about to shock nebulous?
Yeah.
Yes.
I think it is a very nebulous thing.
The literary establishment.
And I was hardly, I mean, when I published a book, I knew nothing about, I mean, I was up in Norwich, and before that I'd been in Brighton, before that I'd been in boarding school, and I knew nothing about this world. But I mean, I guess there is roughly a kind of a London, I mean, it's very London-centered literary world that includes the literary pages of the broadsheets, the TLS, LRB, Literary Review and a handful of others. Certainly if you go to any kind of book launch, you're aware that people aren't exactly stumblingly, shyly being introduced to each other. There's an awful lot of intense interconnectedness. Whether it really adds up to an establishment in the way that the political culture, I guess it's a borrowing from that. I don't really know. I don't think I really did shock the literary establishment. I was absorbed into it immediately. If it was shockable, it didn't show itself to be very.
Yes, perhaps you shocked the.
Actually, I had. I was. In a minor way of literary novels, I had a success with my first book, and it was generously reviewed in all those sort of broadsheet papers I mentioned. But I mean, success meant it sold 2,500 copies, but had gathered some nice reviews. So I think it is a nebulous thing, but it's not particularly conspiratorial. It doesn't have a single mind. It often spends more time attacking itself. I mean, it's quite gossipy. It's quite a village pump thing. It can be quite bitter and unpleasant. But I don't think it has any dominating aesthetic. That's what I think it would need to become a proper establishment.
And something that you might challenge. Loads of questions want to ask you. How are we going to do this? There was somebody just... Yes. I'm here waiting patiently.
First of all, sorry for my English, but I'm Italian, so. And to me, it seems that this book is quite different from the other you wrote. And I can't make connection, but with the story, with the short story, and all the other books, there is a kind of connection in themes and in the way of writing. So, can you do it for me?
Yes. How is Amsterdam connected to the previous books?
Can I do it for you? No. No, I know you're writing a PhD, because I see that steely look in your eye. And no, I can't do it for you. I think it's your job. I just have to do the next thing, really. And I don't think any writer really thinks, well, my themes, as I understand it, are... homicide and rape. So now, what should I do this time? I know I have a woman. You just find yourself after a pause between books, thinking about certain things. And I'm sure that they're ordained somewhat by the complete collective nature of everything that you are, and your personality and taste and everything else about you. But it never feels like an active choice. And it never feels like any particular... It's not in reference to what you feel you've done before. It always... It's a necessary illusion, I think, to think that you're making a complete new start. So...
So where you have the idea this time? Is that a balloon? You have the...
Where did the idea come from?
Yeah, I mean, Enduring Love is a good example. It came from a whole set of... it came partly out of an impatience to get writing on something. I was so stuck with too many ideas. I had a log jam of ideas. So I thought, I'm just going to write something. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm just going to write about a man who has to go and buy a gun. And maybe it's a short story. So I wrote that bit of the Enduring Love, which is about... Joe going to buy a gun off some hippies. In the process of writing that, I thought, I now will write a scene where he's in a restaurant with his wife and her godfather, and there's an attack on his life. Again, only by writing that did I discover who everybody was. I then wrote chunks of the book and slowly decided that this was a failed scientist, a science journalist. Two-thirds of the way through writing the book, I decided to write the beginning. It was a complete mess, in other words. And I had no idea... I don't think it's useful to think thematically. I think for critics it is, but not for writers. You, You're dealing with specific things. And you do it on the basis that if you work honestly and thoroughly and slowly, these things will cohere. You can't bolt it together at the theme level. It's a bottom-up process, to use that fashionable
word. I'm going to take one last question, then I hope that Ian might be kind enough to sign some copies, which I believe are available outside, and then perhaps some of you will get a chance to ask your questions personally and directly to him. The lady at the back over there in the fourth row, thereabouts. Yes, did a particular place inspire the setting for Comfort of Strangers?
Oh, entirely Venice.
I was
still in the grip of Kafka then, and I always felt it was dishonorable to name anything and anywhere in a book. I mean, also I was aware that Venice was a place so constantly recreated in the literary imagination, not only by Thomas Mann, but by Dickens, by Ruskin, powerfully for me, by Henry James, by Jan Morris. I mean, it's endlessly reinvented, so that it becomes a kind of place of the mind. And I thought, based on my own experience of endlessly getting lost there, and always on the far side of the canal from the restaurant I wanted to get to, but no bridge in sight, and the restaurant closing by the time I reached it, that it would serve as a place where two people with a disintegrating relationship might be found. But it was always a version of Venice. I think slightly altered. I think I rotated it at one point just to have the sun through a window. I think I rotated it through 90 degrees. Freedom one has by not naming it. But there's plenty of reference to Ruskin in the novel to make it clearly Venice. There could be no other place.
I'm going to break my own rule and let this lady who's been eagerly waiting for a question ask the absolute last.
How do you feel about the film?
The film of The Comfort of Strangers. I liked it a great deal. It had a marvellous screenplay by Harold Pinter. And when I was seriously interested in screenplays, I was thought that he really was the master of them. They're so spare. A page of a Pinter screenplay is mostly white space. It has virtually no direction. It's much more like a play in the way he goes about this. I think it's very much a filmmaker's film. For Paul Schrader, I think he was very powerfully drawn into the matter at the level of he had a certain idea of sort of beauty and corruption, and there are set pieces of camera movement which I think are absolutely magical. If it had a shortcoming as a film, I think it was entirely to do with the shortcoming of the novel. I think perhaps a lack of motivation, which I think maybe you can get away with in a novella, but becomes somewhat more exposed in film, so that by the end of the last reel, you're more likely to ask yourself, why have I been put through this, than with the novel. But I think, as I say, structurally, I think it just inherited that problem from the novel.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Ian, and thank you to all of you for your questions. I'm sorry you didn't all get a chance to ask them. Perhaps you will get a moment to do it afterwards. But that was splendid, most enjoyable, and very best of luck about the £85,000 we wait to hear.
Thank you.